This is CliffCentral.com.
Just after 7 o'clock, CliffCentral.com. Good morning, everybody. Oh, I got lots to do today. One of the things I want to do today is just talk about the Sunday Times Generation Next. Do you know what that is, Ben?
Yes, Gareth. It's for all the things that are making young people tick.
That's correct. So we're going to speak to Courtney Hoyland, who is the project lead for the Sunday Times Gen Next event. Of course, this delivers insights into youth brand preference and consumer behavior for the 15th time in a row. Isn't that cool? The Youth Marketing Conference, Interactive Showcase, and Awards will be charged with a new energy and loads of inspiration for effective youth engagement strategies for brand, marketing, media, and advertising professionals in the youth marketing space who hope to understand a little bit better what the consumption habits, the trends, and much more among young people are. An interactive showcase of brand activations and sponsorships are available throughout the day. We're going to speak to Courtney. Is she on the line? Hey, Courtney, how are you?
Yes, I am. Hey, I'm good, and you?
Good. All right, so Gen Next, first of all, congrats. 15th time in a row. That's very impressive.
Yeah, we're very excited. It's a big milestone.
Excellent. So tell me what we can expect here.
So, yeah, it's taking place at Sandton Convention Center tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And the day kicks off with the conference, which is for marketers. And there they will tap into insights into how to future-proof their brand.
Yep.
Thereafter, we will go into the interactive showcase part of the day. And that's where the brands will actually have space and activate. And we're going to bring in 1,000 youth.
Oh, wow.
Aged 8 to 23.
Are they just going to sit there?
So, yeah,
and
they're going to spend 3.5 hours just having fun. Sorry?
They're going to sit there and have the brands kind of show off to them a little bit?
Yeah. So, you know, it's really important to have a face-to-face interaction with, you know, this crowd. So,
okay.
Yeah, they're going to be doing fun things, competitions, handouts, food. Yeah, it's going to be chaos,
and then,
but really, really fun.
And then you've got the awards after that, right? That starts about 5 o'clock.
So then so at about 5:30, we'll start the awards, and that's when we announce the brands who have won in the survey, which it's the 15th year that we've done it. So we obviously partner with HDR who do the research for us, and the brands get a chance to see how cool they are.
I think it's really insightful and interesting, and I think a lot of people benefit tremendously from knowing what young people consider to be cool and interesting and, you know, what they're most involved with and where they engage the most and all the rest of it. What kind of level of interest is there among brands? Because it usually gets very competitive.
Yeah, so Gen Next, there's massive interest. I mean, I'm meeting with these guys all the time. It's very rare that I don't go to their offices and see a framed certificate of Gen Next. So they take it very seriously. You know, they do get very excited. If they drop a spot, they are very disappointed. But this year it's quite exciting because we changed up the research and we're launching a few new categories. So there will be brands, for example, the coolest shopping online shopping app, for example. So there's new brands who are now coming into play and have the chance to compete. Obviously, because times are changing, mm-hmm. We decided to change up our research a bit and launch some new categories.
All right. Well, Sia will be coming to represent us and take a look at what's going on over there. But well done to the Sunday Times Generation
Thank
Next.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure. I hope it goes really, really
Thank
well.
Thank you very much.
Sure. No problem. Thanks, Courtney. There's Courtney Hoyland, who's the project lead for the Sunday Times Gen Next event that happens Wow, it's happening tomorrow. It's happening live. It's taking place from early in the morning, 8:30, all the way through until 7 o'clock in the evening. Busy, busy, busy. Sounds good.
Yeah, I know it's youth-focused, but also gives you a great understanding of what brands are doing. So if you're in that kind of industry, it's
right.
A really worthwhile thing that.
Well, if you want to get hold of information like this, there aren't a lot of places that do it as well as the Sunday Times Gen Next Awards. They really do a lot of research. They get stuck in. They go granular. They talk to the young people at schools, at universities, and in various other places, you know, within shopping centers and places where people actually interact with these various brands. So it's exciting.
That's why they're an authority, Gareth.
Correct. All right. How about this brilliant series that we've got on at the moment called Let's Start an Argument? Have you heard about it?
Yes, very good. It's very thought-provoking.
It is, and it's hosted by two very, very clever people. I'll tell you who they are in a minute. But if you want to delve into the messy world of racial identity politics, let's start an argument. Gets to the heart of race, what it means for us today. In episode 3, which is the one we launched today, Cecilia Koch and Dr. Jason Werbeloff tackle how race affects your experience of the world. Is there a quintessential black or white experience? Because we hear about this all the time. But is that so? Get Let's Start an Argument at cliffcentral.com, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts. You know, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get them. Go along and download Let's Start an Argument, especially for the kind of person who wants to have slightly more meaningful and deep conversations about things. Easy enough, right?
Sure.
There we go. One more brilliant series that you could take a look at.
And also a reminder, an argument isn't always the worst thing.
No, it's good.
This is how you learn.
Yeah. No, it's very, very good. In fact, argument is how you know that you are getting under the skin. Argument is how you know you're having real conversations. Because where everything is platitudes and everybody's being polite and everybody's not getting particularly enthusiastic about their point of view, you're probably just skimming on the surface.
Yeah.
So argument is where you test your intellectual mettle against someone else. And if you're no good and you have nothing between your ears, you'll never have arguments. That's the honest truth. Like, people think argument's a bad thing. All right, it's time to find out what Gord Laws is up to. You know, usually on a Wednesday he would be hanging with us, but he is in Holland at the moment. He went and saw Metallica live in Ireland at a castle. He sent us a whole bunch of pictures of that.
It's like Gord's element of elements.
Oh, he's loving it. And now he's in Amsterdam, and he went to see Metallica yet again. He's there with a friend, but he sent us this voice note to just let us in on what he's up to.
So we just realized that we forgot to get going and are missing the one support act of Metallica that we really wanted to watch. But we are so blazed, we literally don't know what planet we're on, and everything is very hectic. We're currently riding on a train. You must know how difficult it is to try to coordinate the instructions for how to get to a Metallica concert and being blazed out of your mind and using like a multi-bus long-distance-ish train system to have to get there, where all the signs are in something like Afrikaans, but not quite. Anyway, we are on the train, having taken the bus, now to get off and walk to the stadium and watch Metallica rip the tits out of it. But we missed Ghost, so we bummed, and purely because we got so blazed that everything went into ultra-slow motion. But it's been a jol, and we'll keep you updated. I haven't even met High Rob yet. I think that's tomorrow.
He really doesn't know what's going on.
He should have had High Rob as like his jol wingman person.
Yeah, High Rob might have helped him a little bit. You know, he could have figured more out and made less mistakes. It sounds like Gord is having the time of his life, though. So there he is, Gord Laws, who is currently blazing up Amsterdam and visiting friends there, and he's apparently going to see some of his favorite bands, and he's going to meet up with High Rob, which is excellent.
I want to hear High Rob's take about that experience.
Uh-oh.
I want to hear both of them in conversation. I reckon that would be fascinating. Don't you want to know what they say to each other? It's like when you, if you could put a camera into like a home where you've got slow adults and listen to what they actually talk. No, like you listen to what they actually talk to each other about.
Mm.
Like, what do they discuss? What are their main topics of conversation? I would be fascinated, don't you think?
Oh.
What are you guys talking about?
Well, that's why it would be so great if Gord had the time to actually make his own podcast. Because I think he would be really good. He would just interview people about random stuff.
Yeah. Like,
and
there
I think
might,
it would be so entertaining.
There might be an in-depth conversation on why peanut butter is so sticky. I think that might happen. So you win some, you lose some with that conversation.
Yeah, because that would be boring. That I can promise you. All right, how about this? Google sent me a bunch of celebrity impressions. Do you want to hear these? I love when someone can get a really good celebrity impression down. There's a guy called Jay Farrow. I think he appeared on Ellen.
Oh,
have you heard of him?
Yes, he's on Saturday Night Live.
Okay, he's on Saturday Night Live. He's also, in this clip, he's with Steve Harvey. He's with Ellen DeGeneres. He does a bunch of them. So here are his impressions. Just listen to this. This is very, very good. Here we are.
So here's the question, Chris. Would you ever consider running for president?
Now he's doing Chris Rock, all right? So here he is.
For president.
Okay. All right, listen. At this point, anybody could be the president. Listen, I don't care Listen.
He's great. That is superb. That is really good. I mean, you close your eyes.
I don't care if Flavor Flav runs. I'll vote for him. If he wins and make Honey Boo Boo the vice president, I don't care.
That is so good. Man, Chris Rock, 100%, right?
I know Jay also has Chris Rock's mannerisms down as well. He does superb. This thing with his fingers often does.
Crosses his fingers and things.
Okay. I, Eddie Murphy, let me talk to you, dog. How would you accept an Oscar?
Well, you know, what first I would say to these people, if I, just hold on, I, you know what I'm saying? I gotta say this, why did it take so long? That's my question. I should have been had me an Oscar. You seen me. Y'all seen me. You seen me do Dream Girl. Oh, yeah. 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 Oh,
he's
yeah,
so
yeah,
good.
Yeah, yes. Yes.
Eddie Murphy.
All right, Kevin. Kevin Hart. I'm talking to you. Kevin, what movie are you upset that you didn't get cast in?
Listen, here's the thing, Steve. Here's the thing. Swear to God. Listen, Steve, the fact is, I do every movie, Steve. I'm everywhere. Listen, it's me, Dwayne Johnson, and Meryl Streep. Swear to God, that's all you get. You know what I mean? It's just that. Bop, 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 bop.
How good is this guy, huh? Man, he is superb.
You know what? Steve, I want to thank you, Steve. I want to thank you. You know why? Tell you why I'm thanking. I'm thanking you because Think Like a Man put me on the map. Bow, bow, bow. It did. You know what I'm saying?
Come on.
They didn't think I was sexy before. Now I can walk outside bare-chested. Everybody's like, oh, my God. Oh, my God.
J-Fair, everybody.
Wow.
How did this work? How long have y'all known each other, and how did this work out? It's a great show, by the way. It's great.
Thank you so much, Ellen. So I met Jamie in 2000.
So this is him and Jamie Foxx on Ellen DeGeneres, just by the
12.
Way.
He was hosting SNL, and he said, "Hey man, I'm a big fan. I think you're amazing. I think you're talented. And you know what? The fizzle with the feezy, I want to work with you in some capacity and way."
And then, like, we got up. I like it. Jamie Foxx has got the best laugh in the world. Ha ha! That's hilarious. So, I mean,
that was amazing. He did the laugh, and then Jamie Foxx did the laugh, and you can't tell the difference.
Mm.
That's phenomenal.
You know, this has been like a fun journey, and finally finding the project to collab with him on has been.
Are you hanging out? What's he like as a friend? I've only ridden my bike to his house once,
that was crazy. Jamie Foxx turns up all the time. You know, he's always turned up. Like, you know, hits you up. But, hey man, what you doing? I'm like, I'm at a funeral. Oh, that's cool. I'm about to bring Leonardo DiCaprio and Odell Beckham through. You like, I don't think that they want to be at the funeral, dog. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think they're going to like that. You know what I mean? He's always ready to party, whatever.
I know I'm hard to hang out with because he's so good at doing impressions, so that's all I do is just all night. Just like, yo, what's up with Jay-Z, man? Where Jay-Z at?
And I'd be like, you know, Hov is cool, you know. Hov is dead, you know. Yeah.
That is so good.
Yo, man, where Kevin Hart at?
Listen, Jamie, swear to God. First of all, it's not type of, you know, publicity I need, right?
Oh, man, that Jay-Z was awesome. Mm. God, I love people who could do impressions like this. It's just such a talent.
It really is. Like, there's got to be something special about either their ears or how they can contort their mouths. There's something, it's a real gift.
Yeah.
It's also about your ear, how your ear picks up these accents and how you're able to replicate that. That's
so
a
good.
True, true talent.
This guy's so good. Jay Farrow.
Mm.
Mm. Hey, you know who we've got popping in a little bit?
Yeah.
Let me get you excited. Vince Wilburn Jr., he is the nephew of Miles Davis. You know who Miles Davis
Spectacular
is,
Spectacular
right?
musical talent.
Yeah, Miles Davis is the greatest jazz trumpeter of all time ever. He used to be the hero of my one-time producer, Thabo Modisane, who could not tell me enough good things about Miles Davis. I mean, he's, you know, his legend, his reputation just grows and grows and grows over the years that have passed since he died. And his album, Kind of Blue, still holds the honor of being the highest-selling jazz album of all time. So we've got his nephew in here to find out about what they're busy with. They're busy producing a really interesting show, and we'll tell you all about that too. So that's coming up in a little bit.
Mm.
Lots to talk about.
Do you want to talk about the life of the rich and the famous? Let's just sneak into that world for 2 seconds.
Right, that'll be nice in the words of Kay Burley.
Maybe. All right, go on. Let's hear about the life
of the rich. In the words of Kay Burley.
Tell us.
I remember we spoke about this when it was first sold back in 2017. This piece of art worth $450 million. Remember that?
Which one was it?
It's by Leonardo da Vinci, and was basically that rare painting that is dubbed the male Mona Lisa because of its similarities.
Yes.
It's called Salvador Mundi.
Yes.
It's a rare painting there. Well, there's just been silence ever since, but now it's been...
Didn't someone buy it and we don't know who it is who bought it?
Oh, now we know who it is.
Okay.
And we now know what they're doing with it because, well, when you're rich, the world is yours.
They hang it in the toilet?
Mm. It was purchased by a Saudi prince. Are we really surprised there?
No.
Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman bought it back in 2017 and now owns the 500-year-old painting. And because I guess then he just fears for his safety and doesn't trust a lot of people, he's been keeping it on a yacht for all of these years, along with some of his other prized possessions, because I guess no one can really reach a yacht in the middle of the ocean.
Well, here's the worry. If that yacht goes down, then so does that painting, and it gets wet and it's ruined.
Mm-hmm.
Stupid Saudi prince.
Well, not even just that painting, all of his other prized jewels, because now insiders call his yacht, this 439-foot boat, basically an art Disneyland. The Saudi prince is one of the biggest art dealers and art buyers in the world. Shucks.
Yeah, he's also a moron to store it all on that boat. I mean, can you imagine if his pilot of the boat crashes into some rocks or something, which could easily happen.
What is that cruise liner, which was docking recently?
In Venice. Mm-hmm. The cruise liner went straight into the dock and, like, tore it up. Now, what if this guy strays into Somalian waters and the Somalian pirates, they're not going to know Salvador Mundi is worth $450 million. Mm. They're going to throw it out into the water.
And that was back in 2017. You know, 2 years later, that price has gone up.
It's probably even more.
Oh, it gives me a headache just thinking about that and the risk.
And let me remind you, Saudi Prince Salman
bin
whatever, in the bin, whatever his name is.
Mohammed bin Salman.
This guy, you know why he's rich?
Because of the Saudi royal family?
Yes. Because his daddy was rich. And you know why his daddy was rich?
Because his daddy was rich.
Correct. And you know why his daddy was rich?
Goats.
Because when the British pulled out of Saudi Arabia... and you can watch Lawrence of Arabia if you want to see the full story. They handed over control of the Saudi Peninsula to the family that they thought were in charge there. And they just said, you guys, we've decided you should be kings. So it was the British who made this whole thing happen and who handed over all this wealth to this Saudi royal family, who, without that happening, we wouldn't even know who they were.
So it wasn't Lawrence then?
It was partly Lawrence. There was an actual Lawrence of Arabia, but you must go and read the story.
And now they just have pocket change of $450 million.
Yeah.
And able to...
The Al Saud family. That's where the name Saudi Arabia comes from.
Well, sticking to matters of water, you know, you might love to live in New York City, but you don't love the hustle and bustle of the city.
Well, then why live in New York City?
Because, you know, you want to be there, but you just don't want to be around a lot of people. Does anyone have a cool $13 million? Because
is Trevor Noah selling his apartment?
No. There's a developer in New York City who's built a private island that you can access just 30 minutes from Manhattan.
Nice.
That has all of these high-class amenities that you may want to have to live a very secluded life, but just don't have a lot of people right on you. The island is 5,600 square feet wide, and the house itself on the island has 4 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, and you get these amazing, amazing views of the city from this island.
Oh, yeah?
How ridiculously rich must you be to say, yeah, I want to be close to the city, but I don't really want to be around people. And so, yeah, that's why I'm going to build an island for it. It was built back then by an Al Sutton. He's a doctor, an actor, an author,
and
producer.
What's this island called?
Well, it's just a private island that Al Sutton built back in 2007. He built the island itself for $1 million and then further invested $8 million over the next 11 years developing it. And so now he just says, okay, yeah, kind of done. I'm 85 years old now. So he's wanting to sell it off.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds amazing.
Oh, now you're sort of into the idea.
Oh, I'm very into this idea. Are you kidding?
$13 million. And then lastly, in the matters of the rich and the famous, anyone have $279 million here?
Not just yet, but carry on.
I think maybe we can all put it together, because sure, the head of the founder of the Discovery Channel is selling his ranch for $279 million.
Oh, that's a good price. What do we get?
Hold on to your pants for this one.
All right.
The ranch is in Colorado. Mm-hmm. And you get, let's say, the basics of what you'd expect for a fee like this. A mansion.
What you got? 1 or 2 horses. You've got some. Mm-hmm.
A mansion that's over 22,000 square feet wide. You know, the mansion has 8 bedrooms, 8 bathrooms.
Yeah, only 8. Okay.
Mm, so right. Far.
You can always build on.
So far, been there, done that. All but right. Now here comes the big ticket. Of course, when you're in Colorado, you want to relax when you're away from people. So how about having your very own private resort and spa?
Yes.
Which comes with a 72-room lodge. Who the heck? Who are you inviting
this.
72 people over at your lodge, Nochal? How, like, insane. It also has a dining area and an auto museum. For that price, you can get more than 50 cars as well, that are spread out over the 8,700-acre garage that's there. And then all of this said and done, maybe this might not impress you as much. Does a private airstrip maybe get you going? An airplane hangar, a helipad, horse stables. And then here's another big kicker. A private observatory with a telescope. And then for that price tag, you can also get yourself a prehistoric dinosaur footprint.
Ah, okay, that's the
welcome.
Thing. You've turned me. I like that.
Yeah, it all sounded like nonsense until the end.
Right.
That dinosaur footprint.
Well, you look at how these people live, these rich people. It's something else, man.
Man, yeah, money's just something else. Tons
and
tons of
money. Well, don't you want
else.
Some? All right, listen. You know that you've made an impact when Rolling Stone calls you the most revered jazz trumpeter of all time, not to mention one of the most important musicians of the 20th century. Miles Davis was a terrific American trumpet player, band leader, one of the most innovative, influential, and respected figures in the history of jazz. For decades, he was a leading figure in the various styles of jazz, combining rock music with jazz. He's credited with some of the biggest hits like Stella by Starlight, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, It Never Entered My Mind. Even after his death in 1991, his legacy continues. Most recently, his nephew, who we're going to talk to in a minute, Vince Wilbon Jr., has kept his uncle's memory alive with the launch of Miles Davis, Birth of Cool, which is a new documentary that focuses on the legend. It will be screened at the 21st Encounters South African International Documentary Festival, which runs from the 6th until 16th of June in Cape Town and Johannesburg. So just a few more days of that left. We're going to find out from Vince what that's all about. And that's coming up next. Miles Davis, man. Thabo Modisani used to get me excited about this. He gave me the album, A Kind of Blue, a long time ago. And that was the first introduction I had to Miles Davis. And it was absolutely beautiful from beginning to end. I cannot profess to be the most enlightened jazz connoisseur in the world, but I can tell you something. You know good when you hear it. And that's true with Miles Davis. So no surprise, really, that there's a brilliant documentary on the go now. The fact that it's happening here in South Africa is very exciting, and you can find out more if you attend the 21st Encounters South African International Documentary Festival. Well, he's here, sitting right next to me. Vince Wilburn Jr., how are you, sir?
Hey, how you doing?
Nice to see you.
Good to be here.
I'm very glad you could be here. First of all, congratulations on the documentary.
Thank you.
How is it doing, and what's the response been? You've done Cape Town already, you're doing Joburg now?
Yes, we're doing Joburg tonight. We had a special screening last night in Soweto.
Mm-hmm.
The response is overwhelming, you know, and each screening, each festival, it's different, you know, people, you have different responses, you know.
Yeah.
From Africa, we've been to South Africa, we've been to, as far as, Sundance and all over the Toronto, you know.
So tell me about the documentary. So it's obviously about Miles Davis, your uncle, but what do you focus on in there, and what kind of new stuff have you been able to find, and what kind of stuff can people expect to see if they come to see the documentary?
Well, it shows an in-depth his life. It's no holds bar. It's you have the drug use.
Yeah.
You know, we touch a little bit on that. What kind of, you know, what made Miles Miles? You know, things that people didn't know. You know, his sensitivity. You know, it's what drove him. You know, so it moves around. It like his career. You know? It's quick.
How well did you get to spend time with him? How well did you know him during the course of his life? I mean, his fame was just enormous. And by the time, you know, you came along, because you're a young man compared to him. He was an old man by the time you came along, right? I mean, how much of your uncle did you actually get to know, and how much time did you get to spend with him?
I lived with Uncle Miles and Aaron, his youngest son, in Malibu. I played drums in his band for 5 years. So I was around him a lot. You know, I was around him as a kid. You know, I grew up in Chicago. So, and then I would spend summers with him in New York. So I was around him pretty much. You know.
And he was a controversial man. I mean, there was a lot that went on in his life. He didn't hold back when it came to saying what he felt about things. He was very outspoken.
Opinionated.
Big time. And a lot of people were very, they found that quite refreshing, because there were a lot of musicians from that era who didn't speak about, you know, some of the more political, some of the more controversial, some of the more difficult social issues.
Mm-hmm.
Miles never held back.
No,
he was very much, you know, offering and willing to give his opinion just about any time of the day.
Yeah, yeah. So you can imagine what my mom was like, his big sister. Right? That's where I grew up. social change. He didn't want to play five sets a night, you know, you guys had to play five, six sets a night. And so he said, no, we play two sets.
Yeah.
And then he caught a lot of flack for that early on in his career, you know, so things like that, you know.
And growing up during his time was very, very different to the way that musicians grow up now. And I mean, there are great musicians who don't have to deal with half the shit that Miles had to deal with when he was young.
Yeah, it's the racial equality, you mm-hmm. know, the
whole civil rights situation.
Man, yeah, yeah, yeah. The you know, in music, when you have to go by what the record company says you have to play, and they pick your songs and tell you what direction to go in. But with Miles, it was like directions of music by Miles Davis.
So he told them what he wanted.
He wanted the can I say Bitches Brew?
Yeah,
I
sure, of right. course, yeah.
When they found out that was the title, you know, the label was like, oh, this, you know, that's going to be the title of the record. And he said, no, I want Bitches Brew. He wanted his wife on the cover. He wanted black women on the cover of his records. You know, who does that? You know,
yeah.
They had a white woman on a sailboat for miles ahead, the record, because of marketing. And they thought it would reach a wider audience to have a white woman in a sailboat and the good life.
And he said
like,
no.
Hell no. He's like, no, no, no.
Well, he also stood up for himself when it came to, you mentioned how he'd play two sets a night, but he didn't tolerate nonsense from the record company either. In a time where the record companies were God,
mm-hmm.
they would
mm-hmm.
set the rules.
Oh, yeah.
They told everybody what to do. They owned you.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody owned Miles.
No, he told Clive Davis, he said, and it's in the documentary, not to give it away, he said, I want to play, you know, all these white-haired white boys playing rock. He said, I want to play those stadiums.
Yeah.
I want to get into that. You know, because in the States, and I don't, maybe it's around the world, but not now, but everything was categorized. You know, you know, you had jazz here, you had rock here, you had pop here. It was in hip-hop back then, but
he
broke down the barriers.
Yeah, he didn't care about that.
No, he wanted to, you know, he called it social music. He hated the word jazz.
Yeah.
He thought jazz was like slavery.
He won 32 Grammys. He's like... 32 Jeez. Grammy Awards, yeah. right?
No, not the, quite that many. No.
I'm pretty sure it was.
If it's 32, I'm looking for some. I'm missing a few.
Are there some in the boxes? Yeah, have we found all of these? You've set up quite a lot in the wake of Miles' death and his extraordinary career. You've set up quite a lot that can allow Miles Davis fans to appreciate the man
mm-hmm.
since his life ended. And I think that's tremendous. It's first of all a matter of great pride for your family, obviously.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's also for fans all over the world. I mean, there are people who are obsessed with your uncle's music.
Yeah,
there are people who have listened to every single note in every album 1,000 times mm-hmm. and can't get enough.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's got to be something amazing to know that you had proximity to this guy, that you played with him, that you actually had the chance to get to talk to him. And now that you've made this documentary, it must make you feel really good that you've done some good deed for the world by showing us this side of him.
Well, what's amazing is he continues to touch the world.
Yeah.
Know? I mean, it's, how many musicians do you know that play with Charlie Parker and Prince, you know? I was in a surf shop in South Africa, in Cape Town, right?
Yeah.
So... my cousin Aaron is a surfer, Miles' youngest son, so he was buying surf merch. And the lady said, you know, he was on the other side of the store. She said, well, why are you guys here? You know, what's the big, you know, what why are you traveling here to Cape Town? So I'm thinking, she's not going to know who Miles Davis is. A young girl, right?
Yeah.
A young surfer, the owner of this surf shop. I said, I'm here. We're doing a documentary on Miles Davis. She said, Miles Davis. She jumped over the counter and she took
the picture. Oh, wow.
So I was like, you know, so you never know. You know, I mean, this man continues. He's been gone since September 28th, 1991. And he continues to touch lives. And it's amazing to me.
And the albums continue to sell, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. We have a release coming out, In a Silent Way, remixed by Q-Tip from Tribe Called Quest. Mm. We have Rubber Band Session coming out. From Warner Rhino, we have the soundtrack for the documentary coming out in September. So it keeps coming. It's vaults of music, you know, of Miles' music.
And there's a lot of material.
Oh, huh? Long after we're gone.
Yeah,
you know? I love going in there and listening to that, you know, outtake tracks and things. It's like it's like Christmas.
and he used to lose his temper really often when people wouldn't do what he needed to do on a record, right?
Oh yeah,
he got cross.
Yeah, he's the next musician. Step
took
up.
It all very seriously.
Oh, yeah.
There's no serious. Messing around.
He said no bullshit in the music.
Right.
Can I
Yeah, of course whoop, you can. Whoop, now you can say bullshit here.
No BS in the music.
You know? Yeah, you can. You
know, take it seriously. And that's what he instilled in Aaron and myself and all the musicians. I call it Miles Davis University.
And Aaron plays?
Aaron played electronic drums after I left the band. But Aaron was my drum roadie. You know, Aaron is younger than I. So when, you know, Uncle Miles wanted him to have that thing on the road.
And Miles' other kids?
They're one's deceased and one's in New York and Cheryl's in Vegas.
Okay.
Las Vegas.
And are they
retired.
Still involved at all in music?
No.
No. No. So it's just Cheryl,
Cheryl was the school teacher, scholar.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, he has a history with South Africa as well because he did some protest music and he was very involved in the fight, obviously, for South Africa and for people here and against South African, you know, the government at the time and
played
for
on the
sanctions.
Sun City.
Yeah, that's right. So tell me about that.
I remember he played on. I remember when he did the recording, and when I was talking last night on the Q&A, you know, I kind of teared up because you have two records, Tutu and a Mandala, right?
Mm.
And that was in 86 and 89, I think it was releases.
Mm-hmm.
And it just hit me like I'm here in South Africa, and those two records were released, and he was very adamant and an advocate of social rights, you know, and so he would probably be like, yeah, here, Neff, he called me Neff, you know, and it's an honor to be here, man, and maybe that's why I cry so much.
Well, it's great.
It's sensitive. It's sensitive to me.
Yeah, of course. Know? And you're here to represent him. He never got to come to South Africa.
No, but he would have now. You know.
Of course.
I'm sure.
I mean, those efforts, I think he raised well over $1 million for the anti-apartheid movement. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We're trying to bring a band here. Miles Electric Band is my band, and it consists of guys that play with Miles. So I'm talking to promoters today about coming and playing, man.
So what is your day-to-day involve with respect to Miles and his legacy? because you're very much the guy who's looking after all of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's Aaron and myself, but it's just, I have my career. I'm writing and I have a studio at my home. So it's like a job, but it's not a job. It's like, it's fun. You know, it's like, okay. You get phone calls from the lawyers and the attorneys and, I mean, lawyers and attorneys. And sure. You know, you get the record people calling you, labels calling you, and you just deal with it. You know, you get into a groove and you make it happen.
And this documentary is obviously going to be seen by Miles Davis fans and by people who didn't know much about Miles until they'll see this. And I think it's probably fair to say that you didn't make it sanitized. You didn't go and try to create some kind of fluff piece on Miles. And you know, he was an all-round great guy, never made any mistakes, didn't have a bad temper.
Now, you know, my other Uncle Vernon, who passed away, this Miles' younger brother, he said that my brother was no angel. He said F an angel. You know, so that kind of, like, you know, we're not proud of the abuse and the drug use, but I mean, it shows you that the man turned himself around, you know, for the betterment of the world. Does that sound corny?
Yeah, no, that's about, I mean,
but,
right.
But it's you want to show the sensitivity. You don't want to hide from the drugs and run from the drugs.
He's a real guy. He had real life problems, like everybody does.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, a lot of music comes from pain, right?
Yeah. That's in the documentary.
Well, there we go.
Have you seen it?
But if you listen to the way he plays, now I'm going to.
Please do.
If you listen to the way he plays,
you can hear it, right?
There's no way you could play a trumpet like that and not have some serious pain in your life.
That's what Quincy Jones said, and pain and happiness too. You know?
Sure, of course, you got to have both. You were very involved in the Don Cheadle movie,
mm-hmm.
right? You had some input there.
I chose Don to play Uncle Miles, and that was Don's directorial debut.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Great actor, huh?
He's a beautiful dude. He's a beautiful human being.
You were happy with that?
Yeah, I was. You know, we caught a lot of flack because people didn't like it. But it was Don's idea.
What did people not like?
Well, they didn't think it was, I guess they were there to see a documentary. But it wasn't, Don never wanted that. He wanted fiction, part fiction. Believe what you want to believe. And look at it that way. But I guess these diehard Miles fans wanted something different. They want the Birth of the Cool. But Herbie Hancock told me once, he said, "Hey man, this movie Miles Ahead was like if your uncle was having a dream." Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the, you know how you have dream, these weird dreams and things move around. So that's the premise I take on it. I loved it. I loved Don.
Miles did meet our own Hugh Masekela, right?
Oh yeah. I met him backstage.
They knew each other quite well. Yeah. And they often, I mean, both being trumpet players, they would often collaborate in America when Hugh was over there.
I think Hugh dug was one of his, you know, Uncle Miles was one of his, you know,
inspirations.
Heroes. Yeah,
sure,
yeah.
Of course.
And I met Hugh's son, Sal Masekela.
You know how big jazz music is in South Africa, right? We've mm-hmm. got massive support for jazz here, and there's an enormous fan base.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people appreciate the work that your uncle did to make jazz mainstream, because jazz was always something that, first of all, it started off as a very popular thing and everybody was involved, but it did at some point reach a stage where it became a little elitist and only a certain crew of people listened to jazz and your uncle's music made that mainstream again and allowed it to be popular. In this country too, I think people are rediscovering that music and rediscovering albums like A Kind of Blue.
I met a guy last night at the Q&A in Soweto, told me the same. That record said it changed his life. And so it's like, you can travel the world. You know, I keep repeating this, but it just amazes me. You know, I'm in Soweto. This guy says, "Hey man, Kind of Blue changed my life." And I'm like, you know, and then the girl at the surf shop, you know, those moments, you know.
Are there stories that you have about your uncle that you haven't told yet, or are there stories you put into this documentary that you were saving?
Yeah, I had a few scenes that I was really emotional in the documentary, but Stanley took it out.
Mm-hmm.
Stanley Nelson, the director.
Right.
But when I look at the doc, I've seen it like 12 times. It hits me. Each time I see it, it's different. I say, wow. And this is my uncle. And I'm like, wow, look at this. Look
it's
at
amazing.
That.
You're even discovering stuff about him.
Yeah, it's amazing, man. It was amazing for me to be around him You know, this guy changed clothes 6 times a day. First one up, really. First one up in the morning, last one to go to sleep at night. And his mind, you know, just like who does that, you know? And the energy, double Gemini, you know, the energy that he had on the daily. Swam. We went up to Pepperdine, it's a university in Malibu, so he swam. He'd come back and cook the most amazing dishes you ever want to eat.
I heard he was a good cook, yeah. Oh, no. Someone told me about that.
Yeah, like a master chef, bouillabaisse, anything. He would have not to give away some of his recipes, he would have fish. He would fry fish and put a little Jack Daniels in the batter back Ooh. Then, but you know, he didn't drink after a while. But
And the women loved him.
Oh. Pasta.
There was no woman sauce. He couldn't have, right? There was no woman in the world he couldn't have.
No, he was. Women were attracted to
they
him.
They loved him.
Yeah. And his wives, I was tight with Frances, who just passed away. She's in the documentary. His right. wife and Cicely Tyson. We talk once a week.
Right.
You know, she's still doing her thing. And, you know, she's like a matriarch. I mean, I travel with her sometimes and she's like, it's the same thing that Miles had. You know, when we go through airports, Cicely has the same thing. It's just like...
People just...
Yeah, they gravitate.
Yeah.
They have tears in their eyes when I'm walking
well, you have to be Miles. Well, you have to be a pretty strong woman to have put up with the force of nature Bingo. That was Miles yeah, Davis,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And I was around when she took Uncle Miles to get his herbs, kicked him, you know, got him help off, you know, weaned him off the coke. And the,
yeah.
You know, she cleaned out the entire townhouse, the brownstone, and down brownstone in New York. She changed it around.
What was his house like when you were spending time with him?
The dark side?
Yeah.
It was pretty dark. He had these drapes, velvet yeah. drapes. They were always
closed,
and it was hard. You know, and he would go and on his benches, and I would stay in the place by myself in the town, in Brownstone by myself, and I was afraid. I was afraid for him. Afraid
How
for
old
myself.
Were you at this stage?
About 15.
Wow. It must have been tough, but when he was on a high and he was just a superhuman.
That's, I called him superhero. I said, I want my superhero back. Yeah. See, you're saying a lot of things that are in the documentary, but this is you know what I mean. That's the way I was feeling. I said, I want my superhero back. You know, I said, Uncle Miles, don't go. You know, for a kid, it's like,
that's
and he's
hard.
Your uncle. Oh yeah, mm-hmm. Shut up. I'll be back. And then he just kicked it, and then he wanted to make a record.
He went cold turkey, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, a few times. Off of heroin and then off the drugs, off the cocaine and the beer.
And you know, there's this weird relationship between so many great musicians and drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Because some of them are so creative on that stuff, whether it's, you know, the good stuff or the bad. Because people say, you know, these drugs are the bad ones and those ones are the good ones. But there are musicians who find a lot of inspiration because it triggers all kinds of imagination and they go into a state of euphoria and they can write stuff that we still look at today as being priceless,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's also the tough times that make them creative, right?
Yeah.
And with him, just such ups and downs, such extremes of emotion.
Well, like you said, it's his personality, the pains and the ups and the downs and the, you know, it's you can hear it in that trumpet, you know, when he puts that, you know, I've experienced on stage. I experienced that muted trumpet and it's like, it's hypnotic, you know, all over the world, Japan, no matter where we were, you know, we had a set list, but the songs varied every night. You know, the same set list, but each song was different every night.
Did he ever get any shit from people because he had you in his band?
No, because I played my ass off. No.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't nepotism.
He didn't let
no,
you get off.
No, it wasn't nepotism.
If you didn't
do something right, you were out. My ass was gone. It was no nepotism. and I wasn't afraid because I was ready.
Yeah.
You know? It was a song called Human Nature, and the drummer didn't want to play it.
Hmm.
So I was in the control room co-producing, and he said, come on out and play. I didn't even have time to think about it. I said, okay. Counted it off. We moved the other drummers out.
Brought yours in.
Shit, I was ready. And you don't have time to get nervous. You know, that's what playing with him did to all of us.
Vince, did you ever speak to him about his legacy? Did you ever have a conversation with him where he explained to you how he felt about his contribution to music and humanity?
No, because he wasn't that kind of guy. You know, he never wanted to look back. I one day we were we were traveling somewhere in Europe, in France, I think. And I had a Walkman, and I had a cassette of the quintet, the second quintet with Tony Williams, Herbie Ron, and Wayne. And he said, give me that cassette. Because he could hear it in my headphones, and he never gave it back. So I don't think he wanted to look back, and I never asked him about what was that like, you know.
And he never did any of that nostalgic stuff of listening to old albums or anything.
No, they weren't in the house.
Really? He didn't have his own music on?
No, not the old music.
Because you hear about a lot of these musicians and they're playing their own songs whenever they're trying to seduce a woman or whatever. Miles never had any of his own music around?
He used to have a good Prince on the phone. You know, like Moving Forward, Skritti Politti, Mr. We were reaching out to those guys on the phone to record that kind of music. You know, MTV was big then. So he would have the sound turned down, and if it was something he liked, he'd turn it up.
But unlike other musicians, he did get to experience the love and the respect of the music industry during his lifetime.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because there's some people who obviously they only get that when they're dead.
Yeah, no.
And he had a lot of that, right?
Yeah, and we would see like his older friends in the airport and backstage and at festivals and stuff, you know. So he would give them big hugs and, you know, so he didn't talk about it, but he would feel great when he was run into Max Roach or some guys backstage or Herbie or anybody that we were on the festivals with.
And the music business has changed so much since he died in 91. I mean, now, if you think about how music is sold and how little money there is in actually making the music, it's all in performances, right?
Yes.
And he did a lot of performances, but he probably would have been annoyed by the kinds of pressures that musicians are under now to make a career like he had.
Yeah, but
it's almost impossible.
I think that he still would have been leading us, you know, in some way. You know, I think that there's no record stores anymore, and especially in the United States. There are no music programs in the States and for kids and in some of these schools, you know. And so it's a different climate. You know, I used to like to go to a record store, read the albums, you know, read the covers. And then buy the albums. That's what my boys did. That was our, you know, that was our fun on a Saturday, riding the train downtown in Chicago and picking up a couple of albums and then coming back and critiquing them, you know. But can't do that anymore. You know, kids don't even listen to entire albums.
They don't have albums.
They get
like a single.
No CDs, no albums. You know,
downloaded illegally. Somewhere.
Everything streamlined.
Where do you go for inspiration now? Because it's not as if music, all the good songs have been written. There are good songs coming out every day, but where do you go to find them?
I just search iTunes. And I'm always like trying to find some new music.
You have friends who also suggest stuff to you?
I got DJs. I call DJs up, you know, because they know all the music.
Yeah.
Q-Tip and all my buddies, you know. I call Q-Tip because Q-Tip is... He's a bad cat. You know, Tribe Called Quest, right?
No, yeah, of course. Yeah,
Cats from the Roots.
Do you think Miles would have collaborated with those guys if he were around today?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
Q-Tip and Tribe Called Quest.
You got into electronic dance music and hip-hop.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Kanye and U2 and Foo Fighters and, you know, yeah, man. Who's to say, you know? I'm sure that he would have.
It's so interesting that he was one of these people who broke down all those barriers between the genres, because I've always maintained, and I hope you'll back me up on this, great music isn't about the genre. That's only important to the person who puts the records in the store.
Right.
I have to put them in categories.
Right, right.
Anybody who loves a song, you could hear a melody, you could hear a beat, you could hear some part of a song that you just love, and it doesn't matter what genre it comes from, right?
Not at all.
No, good music is great.
We've got a few tunes. We have a song with Letticy. We have a song with Layla Hathaway, Donny Hathaway's daughter, coming out. So it's like, we'll probably catch flack for that, but.
So what?
Yeah. I'm happy.
But
I'm proud.
Purists. There are purists.
We got it from miles ahead. People hated it.
But these purists, they're also the people who put Miles on a pedestal. They wanted to see him as being like a saint.
Mm-hmm.
And he's in their pantheon of gods, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And these jazz purists, they're the ones who expect you to evangelize their version of Miles, even if you knew other things about him.
You know, my dad, when I was a kid, my dad had friends who liked the electric Miles and the acoustic Miles. So down in the basement, when they had a couple of shots, they would argue.
Yeah.
And my dad would end the argument and say, hey, this is my damn house. This is my turntable. I'm going to play what I want to play. So that ended the electric acoustic argument.
Well, you know. I want to let everybody know that they can go and see the documentary. It is on at the 21st Encounters South African International Documentary Festival. It runs from the 6th to the 16th of June. So we only got a few days left over of that in Johannesburg. You could probably meet Vince there. You're going around meeting people?
I'm there. Come on out.
Wow, man. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you, man. Thanks for having me.
You got some miles in you, man.
That's what they say.
Yeah, you do.
That's what they say.
It must be quite something. Like, were you his favorite nephew?
I hope so.
I'm sure you are now. The documentary is great. It is. It's really worth checking out. I've heard from everybody who's seen it, and we have the producer, the visionary, the innovator, the originator, the guy who came up with this. He is Miles Davis's cousin. He's Vince Wilbon Jr., and you can find out more by going to see the documentary at that festival. Awesome.
Peace.
Thank you, sir.
Peace.
What a pleasure to see you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Very good. We got lots of other good stuff coming up through the course of your day today. CliffCentral.com. Make sure that you are part of it. And we will fill you in on all the other things that are happening through the course of the day, the other series that are available, and blah, 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 blah. You know what I'm talking about. All right. Have an excellent day.
This is CliffCentral.com.